The challenge of how to combine integration policy with immigration policy is what we face. And those two things are oftentimes not viewed as things that should be dealt with together. How did you know my life history? Well, if things get back to normal, I mean, if they don't get back to normal, you know, we're not going to have any money to buy strawberries. But but I think we all assume that some kind of normalcy will return. So what do we do? I mean, going forward, do we just be a little bit more sensible? I mean, I think the current administration will have there will probably be enough votes in Congress to pass some sort of immigration reform. Should that be a guest worker program? Should it be a guest worker program run by employers? That's what exists in Kuwait. That's what the slaves had in the early days in Virginia. Guest worker programs where the employer calls the shots and pulls the strings and gets the visa are not too different from indentured servitude programs. That's what we had on the books early in the comprehensive immigration reform. But then we moved to a more enlightened guest worker program where the visa would go to the worker. But there's no known guest worker program anywhere in the world that has very effectively worked, primarily because, as the German foreign minister in the 60s said, after, you know, queried about whether he thought of their guest worker program, he said, well, in the beginning we thought we were getting workers, and then we found out we were getting people. And for people, life is sticky, so to speak. I mean, they develop friendships, they have girlfriends, they have boyfriends, they get married, they have children, et cetera, et cetera. And the Turks stayed in Germany. People will stay in the United States. The problem, I think, with the guest worker program, apart from all these practicalities, going back to this question of combining integration and immigration policy, is that it's bad for integration. It might provide labor, but we're telling immigrants, you're not good enough to be a new member of this society. You're not even good enough to start at the bottom. You can only come on a temporary basis and work. Now look at what's happening in our high-skilled workers now. We have a pretty large H-1B program where we bring, give a three-year visa to, these are mostly college graduates to work in the high-tech sector, renewable for 3 years. And these are attractive to such workers for a variety of reasons. One, many of them have been students here. So you can be a student here, graduate in electrical engineering from UCI, become an H-1B worker, last 6 years, and then think you're going to become a legal permanent resident. mean, we're letting in 200,000-300,000 of the, and letting in, we need, in most years, upwards of 300,000 of these workers. But you know how many legal permanent resident slots we have for high-skilled workers every year? About 70,000. It's actually 140,000, but half of them go to family members. So there's not nearly enough to meet the demand. So what's happening? What's happening now is, you know, this started in the late 1990s. People ran through their 6 years. Now we're starting to get lots of unauthorized, illegal Chinese and Indian college graduate computer scientists and engineers spreading out from Silicon Valley to places like Boise, Idaho, Omaha, Nebraska, et cetera, because they want to be legal. Their work is needed. They have no trouble getting jobs, but there's no legal visas. So the same thing is going to happen, I think, with the guest worker program. And at the bottom end of the distribution. So I think we should have more legal permanent resident entrants, allow people, a greater number of people to come in, perhaps on a temporary basis, perhaps on a 3-year basis initially, as legal temporary workers, but then they become, if they apply and want to, become legal permanent residents after that. By my calculations, in normal economic times, somewhere from 200,000 to 300,000 per year would be about the right number. During recessions, we might need to try to adjust that, upward or downward. But the reason I think that's better is I think it's better for citizenship. I mean, I think it sends a message that we expect you to become, you may be starting at the bottom, but we welcome you as a legal permanent resident, as a new member of this society, to hopefully take advantage of whatever opportunity. For the purposes of integration policy, I think that takes us a lot farther down the road than this message that, no, you can't be a full member of society, you can only be a part-time worker, and then we expect you to go home. Now, somebody, you know, the realist would say, okay, that makes sense, but that's not gonna stop unauthorized migration. And that might be the case. Neither will a guest worker program. But the guest worker program won't foster the kind of emphasis on citizenship and integration that I think we're going to have to pay attention to if we want to deal with the increasing inequality that I think is causing so many other kinds of problems in the society. I guess I went on and on based on strawberries. Yeah. I think we've got to lift the whole society as part of that, rather than just being accommodating to immigrants. Yeah, I mean, I'm all in favor of welcoming and integrating immigrants, but I do think that we've neglected the bottom three-fourths of our society for about 35 years. We can go on a little bit what that consists of. And for those of us who work in the area of immigration and care about immigrant situations and so forth, I think we would make a mistake if all we focus on now, with a new administration and a new time, is trying to do something for immigrants but not paying any attention to all the other groups in society that, as Bruce Price said, have been hurting for quite some period of time. I think that will ultimately defeat the what we want to try to achieve for newcomers as well as old timers. We need to have a tide that lifts all boats, not just the biggest yacht. Yeah, let's see, he's had his hand up a long time. I think that's a risk. I don't think it was much of an issue in the presidential campaign because there was no percentage in it on the Republican side. They had this large group of people that were adamantly anti-immigrant, mostly for social and cultural reasons. On the Democratic side, it didn't really have to get addressed in part. It's interesting because it's mostly been a nonpartisan issue. It became something of a partisan issue this past election cycle, but that support and opposition to immigration has existed in both the Democratic and the Republican parties, which has made it a more an interesting area in which to do research and make policy recommendations. Because I think if you do research and you come out with a conclusion that's totally distorted, you'll get called on it. Whereas I think with partisan issues, that is where the political party tends to be united. All agreed on, they'll tolerate distortion for the sake of consensus. But there's not been agreement in the two political parties on this. So I'm not sure I got at what you were addressing, but I think there is a danger that the tough economy will cause things to be much more difficult. I think sustainable activities of all kinds are really important everywhere. But the problem with the, I agree that we could probably do with fewer people in the world. But we can't, it seems to me in the United States, we can't pull up the bridge to the moat and say that we want to protect ourselves from everybody, from the rest of the world, and have a much, even though we have much smaller population density, much lower population density than many other places in the world, agree, who needs more than 300 million people? But we're all in this together on a global basis. Well, the population control thing? It is a political question, because a substantial part of the anti-immigrant political lobby in the United States comes from anti-population growth people. And they're not, they're, a lot of them are pretty sensible people. But they don't want any more immigration because they don't want any more population growth. And it seems to me, I mean, I can understand that at one level, but population growth and climate problems, global warming and so forth, I think is something that we've got to address on a global basis, not just pull up the drawbridge and say, I'm going to circle the wagons and live in my cocoon. We can't do that anymore, clearly, it seems to be. I'm not sure I got your question. Totally wide open borders, Wall Street Journal approach, free market economy. Anything goes? I think we've seen the results of that the last two or three years in the financial market. But it's not easy, because basically there, at the present time throughout the world, there are many more people who could be and want to be and seek to be workers than there are jobs for them to do. China is a case in point. Mexico is still in that situation. It's going to take, I think, bilateral cooperation between our countries to try to work something out. The most innovative place I know of that's flexible and willing to try new things, as best I can tell, is Spain. You know, they've entered into a bilateral agreement with Senegal to, you know, they said, we'll take some of the Senegalese instead of having them ride these rickety boats and go to the Canary Islands. But in exchange for our accommodating a certain number of Senegalese interns, they asked the Senegalese government to keep others from coming. Well, it doesn't seem to be working, but I commend the Spanish for trying. I mean, you know, the Senegalese government doesn't seem to have the resources and infrastructure and wherewithal to hold up their side of the bargain. The other thing that the Spanish are now trying is they're paying people who've been around for a while to 3 years, 5 years to go back. Whatever. At least they're trying something. They're willing to commit sins of commission or errors of commission, as opposed to just saying, well, I'm going to build a fence and hide behind it. So. Well, really work with Mexico. I mean, with Mexico, sit down with Mexico and see if we can come to an accommodation that would work for both countries. Mexico talks a good line on this floor, and neither side has been willing to do very much. I mean, they've done a few things here and there. But, you know, Mexico loves illegal migration, and they want remittances. Mexico loves guest worker programs, and the idea that it's temporary, because that will increase keep the remittance flow going back to Mexico. They haven't really done a whole lot other than make some pronouncements to foster immigrant integration in the United States. But we have new problems, we being the United States, we have new problems vis-a-vis Mexico now, because of the drug situation, I mean, which we're involved in creating. But, you know, things are, conditions are not the same in Mexico right now as they were 10 years ago. And whether they'll change soon, I don't know. That's no reason not to try. But there are lots of things that could be done on both sides there. The United States could encourage Mexico to invest more in infrastructure development as far as its oil industry is concerned. I mean, Mexico should have done that anyway, because it's in its own best interest to do it. But, you know, maybe we can dialogue there and get something. This is all very idealistic. But okay, you pick the person, Jerry. There's lots of hands out here. Corn industry is another example. No, I absolutely. Well, I think the reality really is that about 80% of the population views it as on the same boat. It seems to be about 20%, maybe 25%, that is really anti-immigration, anti-immigrant. Because they seem to feel about six times more strongly about it than the rest of it. But in terms of a wedge issue, it's not been a winning wedge issue. Every single politician who's made that the centerpiece of their political campaign has gone down in flames. So it's not at all clear that unless the economy just continues to really to tank, I think that kind of thing is just not going to get any traction. I do think there'll be a lot of noise, but. Jerry, I'm going to leave this up to you.
We're done.
Well,
you can buttonhole Frank at the reception. Thanks very much, Frank, for a very illuminating talk about the some of the history and concepts and helping us probe what are clearly complex issues that we'll have to continue to deal with. It's a library tradition to thank our speakers by placing a book plate and a book in our collections that commemorates the event and the presentation. So Frank, we've chosen one of your own books on immigration, and it is America's Newcomers and the Dynamics of Diversity by Frank Bean and Gillian Stevens. So there will be a book plate that looks like this that goes into the event, and this is your copy. Our exhibits take a tremendous amount of expert work from talented library staff, and I want to recognize a few of them, Julie Casera, Sage Kim, and Sylvia Irvine from Library Design Services prepare and install the exhibit and design our publications and do a wonderful job. Many of you here tonight are members of our partners of the Libraries Group, and we appreciate your support. The partners help the libraries maintain and enhance our collections and services and public programs particularly. If you enjoyed tonight's program, I hope you'll pick up a brochure at the table in the back and consider joining the Friends if you're not. Also, at the table outside is a checklist of the exhibit. It looks like the invitation you received in the mail, but I assure you there's more information inside there that you will find of interest, I hope. Our next event will be on January 21st, which is the day after the presidential inauguration. It was deliberately and specifically designed for that time. It features Professor Mark Petracca speaking on the vote heard round the world, reflections on the 2008 presidential election. Many of you are probably familiar with Mark from his many media appearances, as he's an expert on American governmental institutions and an astute observer of presidential politics. So, and perhaps we can even continue this discussion with Mark. So again, thank you for coming, and please stay to enjoy the reception and the exhibition. Good night.
One. I mean, they weren't all timed, you know, correctly, but there's one that didn't get shown. There's only one graph. Yeah, it was kind of funny. I found out about it yesterday. And I just kind of, I don't know, in passing mentioned it to Carolyn. She said, they wanted a PowerPoint? So I guess they just had it. And resubmit today in social forces. Yeah.
It must be nice to be working on a topic that everybody.
Yeah. I got a book. Migration and economic growth that was cited in this paper. It's by a historian, right, an economic historian. Anyway, I ordered a copy of this book, Brian Lee Thomas. Right? So I ordered a copy of this book, used, and it came to me with, published in 1954, and it came with a